everyone. My name is Elijah Davis, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation outside of 12th Hour Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is April 15, 2017, or it's April 19, 2021. We will start our second service on the Sabbath day with a song entitled, "The King is Coming." The marketplace is empty, no more traffic in the streets. All the builders' tools are silent, no more time to harvest wheat. Busy housewives cease to labor in the courtroom of debate. Work on earth is all suspended as the king comes through the gate. Oh, the king is coming, the king is coming. I just heard the trumpet sounding, and now his face I see. Oh, the king is coming, the king is coming. Gracia, he's coming for me. Happy faces on the hallway, those whose lives have been redeemed. Broken homes that he has mended, those from prison he has freed. Little children and the aged, hand in hand stand all aglow. We were crippled, broke, and ruined, but in John this what is known. Oh, the king is coming, the king is coming. I just heard the trumpet sounding, is coming, the king is coming. Praise God, he's coming for me. I can hear the churches rumble, I can see the marching throng. The flurry of your trumpets spell the end. Yes, and I'm wrong. Regal robes are now unfolding. Heaven's grandstand saw and played. Heaven's bar is now assembled. Short to see amazing grace. For the king is coming, the king is coming. I just heard the trumpet sounding, and now his face I see. Oh, the king is coming, the king is coming. Praise Yah, he's coming for me. Part 11, Passover, we're going to continue our series now. The Smitten Rock, page 413, Patriarchs and Prophets. Just before the Hebrew host reached Kadesh, the living stream ceased that for so many years had gushed out beside their encampment. It was the Yahshua's purpose again to test his people. He would prove whether they would trust his providence or imitate the unbelief of their father. They were now in sight of the hills of Canaan. A few days' march would bring them to the borders of the promised land. They were but a little distance from Edom, which belonged unto the descendants of Esau, and through which lay the appointed route unto Canaan. Well, the direction had been given unto Moses, "Turn ye northward, and command thou the people, saying, ye are to pass through the coast of your brethren, the children of Esau, which dwell in Seir, and they shall be afraid of you. You shall buy meat of them for money that ye may eat, and ye shall also buy water of them for money that ye may drink. These directions should have been sufficient to explain why their supply of water had been cut off. They were about to pass through a well-watered, fertile country in a direct course unto the promise to the land of Canaan. Yahweh had promised them an unmolested passage through Edom and an opportunity to purchase food, and also water sufficient to supply the host. The cessation of the miraculous flow of the water should therefore have been a cause of rejoicing, a token that the wilderness wandering was ended. Had they not been blinded by their unbelief, they would have understood this. But that which should have been an evidence of the fulfillment of the Yahweh's promise was made the occasion of the doubt and murmuring. The people seemed to have given up all hope that the Yahweh would bring them into the possession of the Canaan, and they clamored for the blessings of the wilderness. Before Yahweh permitted them to enter Canaan, they must show that they believed His promise. The water ceased before they had reached Edom. Here was an opportunity for them, for a little time, to walk by the faith instead of the sight. But the first trial developed the same turbulent, unthankful spirit that had been manifested by their fathers. No sooner was the cry for the water heard in the encampment than they forgot the hand that had for so many years supplied their wants. And instead of turning unto Elohim for the help, they murmured against him in their desperation, exclaiming, "Would Elohim that we had died when our brethren died before the Yahweh." That is, they wish they had been of the number who were destroyed in the rebellion of Korah. Their cries were directed against Moses and Aaron. "Why have you brought up the congregation of Yahweh into this wilderness, that we and our cattle should die there? And wherefore have you made us to come up out of Egypt to bring us in unto this evil place? It is no place of the seed, or of the figs, or of the vines, or of the pomegranate. Neither is there any water to drink." For the leaders went to the door of the tabernacle and fell upon their faces. Again, the glory of Yahweh appeared, and Moses was directed, "Take the rod and gather thou the assembly, together thou and Aaron, thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water, and thou shalt bring forth to them water out of the rock." For the two brothers went on before the multitude, Moses with the rod of Yahweh in his hand. They were now aged men. Long had they borne with the rebellion and obstinacy of the Israel, but now at the last even the patience of the Moses gave away. "Hear now, ye rebels," he cried, "but must we fetch you water out of this rock?" And instead of the speaking unto the rock as Yahweh had commanded him, he smote it twice with the rod. For the water gushed forth in the abundance to satisfy the host. But great wrong had been done. Moses had spoken from the irritated feeling. His words were an expression of the human passion rather than of the holy indignation, because Elohim had been dishonored. "Hear now, ye rebels," he said, "this accusation was true. But even truth is not to be spoken in a passion or impatience. When Elohim had bidden Moses to charge upon Israel their rebellion, their words had been painful unto himself and hard for them to bear, yet Yahweh had sustained him in delivering the message. But when he took it upon himself To accuse them, he grieved the Spirit of Yahweh and wrought only harm unto the people. His lack of the patience and self-control was evident. Thus the people were given occasion to question whether his past course had been under the direction of the Yahweh and to excuse their own sin. Moses, as well as they, had offended Yahweh. His course, they said, had from the first been open unto criticism and censure. They had now found a pretext which they desired for rejecting all the reproofs that Elohim had sent them. Through his servant, Moses manifested distrust of Yahweh. Shall we bring water? He questioned as if the Yahweh would not do what he promised. You believe me not, Yahweh declared unto the two brothers, to satisfy me in the eyes of the children of Israel, to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel. At the time when the water failed, their own faith in the fulfillment of Yahweh's promise had been shaken by the murmuring and rebellion of the people. The first generation had been condemned to perish in the wilderness because of their unbelief, yet the same Spirit appeared in their children. Would these also fail receiving the promise? Wearied and disheartened, Moses and Aaron had made no effort to stem the current of the popular feeling. Had they themselves manifested unwavering faith in Yahweh, they might have set the matter before the people in such a light as would have enabled them to bear this task. Now the prompt, decisive exercise of the authority vested in them as magistrates, they might have quelled the murmur. It was their duty to put forth every effort in their power to bring about a better state of things. For asking Yahweh to do the work for them, had the murmuring at Kadesh been promptly checked, what a train of the evil might have been prevented. By his rash act, Moses took away the force of the lesson that Elohim purposed to teach. The rock, being a symbol of Yahshua, had been once smitten as Yahshua was to be once offered. The second time it was needful only to speak to the rock, as we have only to ask for blessings in the name of Yahweh, of Yahshua. By the second smiting of the rock, the significance of this beautiful figure of Yahshua was destroyed. More than this, Moses and Aaron had assumed power that belongs only unto Yahweh. For the necessity for the divine interposition made the occasion one of the great solemnity, and the leaders of Israel should have improved it to impress the people with reverence for Yahweh and to strengthen their faith in his power and goodness. When they angrily cried, "Must we fetch you water out of this rock?" they put themselves in Yahweh's place as though the power lay with himself. Men possessing human frailty and passions, wearied with the continual murmuring and rebellion of the people, Moses had lost sight of his almighty helper, and without the divine strength he had been left to mar his record by an exhibition of the human weakness. The man who might have stood pure, firm, and unselfish until the close of his work had been overcome at last. Yahweh had been dishonored before the congregation of Israel, when he should have been magnified and exalted. Yahweh did not on this occasion pronounce judgment upon those whose wicked course had so provoked Moses and Aaron. All the reproof fell upon the leaders. Those who stood as Yahweh's representatives had not honored him. Moses and Aaron had felt themselves aggrieved, losing sight of the fact that the murmuring of the people was not against them but against Yahweh. It was by looking unto themselves, appealing unto their own sympathies, that they unconsciously fell into sin and failed to sit before the people their great guilt before Yahweh. Bitter and deeply humiliated was the judgment immediately pronounced. Yahweh spake unto Moses and Aaron, "Because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel. Therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. With the rebellious Israel, they must die. Before crossing the Jordan, had Moses and Aaron been cherishing self-esteem or indulging a passionate spirit in the face of the divine warning reproof, their guilt would have been far greater. But they were not chargeable with willful or deliberate sin. They had been overcome by a sudden temptation, and their contribution was immediate and heartfelt. Yahweh accepted their repentance, though because of the harm their sin might do among the people, he could not remit his punishment. Moses did not conceal his sentence, but told the people that since he had failed to ascribe glory unto Yahweh, he could not lead them into the promised land. He bade them mark the seven punishments visited, or the severe punishments visited upon him, and then consider how Yahweh must regard their murmurings in charging upon a mere man the judgments which they had by their sins brought upon themselves. He told them how he had pleaded with Yahweh for remission of the sins and had been refused. Yahweh was wroth with me for your sakes, he said, and would not hear me. On every occasion of the difficulty of the trial, the Israelites had been ready to charge Yahweh or Moses with the having led them from Egypt, as though Elohim had had no agency in the matter. Throughout their journeys, as they had complained of the difficulties in the way and murmured against their leaders, Moses had told them, your murmurings are against Yahweh. It is not I, but Yahweh, who has wrought in your deliverance. But his hasty words before the rock, shall we bring water, were a virtual admission of their charge and would thus confirm them in their unbelief and justify their murmurings. Yahweh would remove this impression forever from their minds by the forbidding Moses to enter into the promised land. Here was the unmistakable evidence that their leader was not Moses, but the mighty angel of whom the Yahweh had said, behold, I send an angel before you to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice, for my name is in him. So that would be Yahshua, as we know that Yahweh's name is in the Son. Okay, let's go on into the Yahweh was wroth with me for your sakes, said Moses. The eyes of all Israel were upon Moses, and his sin cast a reflection upon Yahweh, who had chosen him as the leader of his people. The transgression was known unto the whole congregation, and had it been passed by lightly, the impression would have been given that unbelief and impatience under the great provocation might be excused and those in responsible position. But when it was declared that because of that one sin Moses and Aaron were not to enter Canaan, the people knew that Yahweh is no respecter of persons and that he will surely punish the transgression. For the history of Israel was to be placed on record for the instruction and warning of the coming generation. Men of all future time must see the Elohim of heaven as an impartial ruler, in no case justifying sin. If few realize the exceeding sinfulness of sin, men flatter themselves that Elohim is too good to punish the transgression, but in the light of the Bible history, it is evident that Yahweh's goodness and his love engage him to deal with sin as an evil fatal to the peace and happiness of the universe. Not even the integrity and faithfulness of Moses could avert the retribution of his fault. Yahweh had forgiven the people greater transgression, but he could not deal with sin in the leaders as in those who were led. He had honored Moses and above every other man upon the earth. He had revealed unto him his glory, and through him he had communicated his statutes unto Israel. The fact that Moses had enjoyed so great light and knowledge made his sin more grievous. Past faithfulness will not atone for one wrong act. The greater the light and privileges are granted unto man, the greater is his responsibility, the more aggravated his failure, and the heavier his punishment. Moses was not guilty of a great crime as a man would view the matter. His sin was one of a common occurrence, for the psalmist said that he spake unadvisedly with his lips. And to the human judgment, this may have been a light thing. But the Yahweh dealt so severely with this sin in his most faithful and honored servant, he will not excuse it in others. For the spirit of self-exaltation, the disposition to censor our brethren, is displeasing to Yahweh. Those who indulge in these evils and cast doubt upon the work of Yahweh and give the skeptical an excuse for their unbelief. It says these are those who indulge in these evils cast doubt upon the word of Yahweh and give the skeptical an excuse for their unbelief. The more important one's position and the greater his influence, the greater is the necessity that he should cultivate patience and humility. If the children of Israel, children of Yahweh, especially those who stand in the positions of the responsibility, can be led to take unto themselves the glory that is due unto Yahweh, Satan exults. He has gained a victory. It was thus that he fell. Thus he is most successful in tempting others to ruin. It is to place us on our guard against his devices that the Yahweh has given in his word so many lessons teaching the danger of self-exaltation. There is not an impulse of our nature, not a faculty of the mind, or an inclination of the heart, but needs to be moment by moment under the control of the Spirit of Yahweh. There is not a blessing that Yahweh bestows upon man, nor a trial which he permits to befall him, but Satan both can and will seize upon it to tempt, to harass, and destroy the soul. If we give him the least advantage, therefore, however great one's spiritual light, however, which he may enjoy of the divine favor and blessing, he should ever walk humbly before the Yahweh, pleading in the faith that Yahweh will direct every thought and control every impulse. All who profess righteousness are under the most sacred obligation to guard the spirit and to exercise self-control under the greatest provocation, for the burden placed upon the Moses is very great. Few men will ever be so severely tried as he was. Yet this was not allowed to excuse his sin. Yahweh, who made ample provisions for his people, and if they rely upon his strength, they will never become the sport of circumstances. For the strongest temptation cannot excuse sin. However great the pressure brought to bear upon the soul, transgression is our own act. It is not in the power of the earth or hell to compel anyone to do evil. Satan attacks us at our weak points, but we need not be overcome. However severe or unexpected the assault, Yahweh has provided help for us, and in his strength we may conquer. That ends our chapter 37, entitled The Smitten Rock. Now we're going to change the subject a little bit, but we're going to continue on with the theme of the Passover. With the first king of Israel, chapter 59, Patriarchs and Prophets, page 603, says, "For the government of Israel was administered in the name and by the authority of the Yahweh. For the work of the Moses of the 70 elders, of the rulers and judges, was simply to enforce the laws that Yahweh had given. They had no authority to legislate for the nation, This was and continued to be the condition of the Israel's existence as a nation. From age to age, men inspired by the Yahweh were sent to instruct the people and to direct in the enforcement of the laws. For the Yahweh foresaw that Israel would desire a king, but he did not consent unto a change in the principles upon which the state was founded. For the king was to be the vicegerent of the Most High. Yahweh was to be recognized as the head of the nation, and his law was to be enforced as the supreme law of the land. Now that's what he intends for the law to be here in the United States. The law of his government in heaven is to be the law of the land here, just like it was to Israel. When the Israelites first settled in Canaan, they acknowledged the principles of the theocracy, and the nation prospered under the rule of Joshua. But the increase of the population and intercourse with the other nations brought a change, for the people adopted many of the customs of their heathen neighbors, and thus sacrificed unto a great degree their own peculiar holy character. Gradually they lost their reverence for the Yahweh and ceased to prize the honor of being his chosen people. Attracted by the pomp and display of the heathen monarchs, they tired of their own simplicity, for the jealousy and envy sprung up between the tribes, for the internal dissensions made them weak, as they were continually exposed and to the invasion of their heathen foes, and the people were coming to believe that in the order for the maintaining of their standing among the nations is with the tribes being united under a strong central government. As they departed from the obedience of the Yahweh's law, they desired to be freed from the rule of their divine sovereign, and thus the demand for a monarchy became widespread throughout the land of Israel. Since the days of the Joshua, the government had never been conducted with so great wisdom and success as under the Samuel's administration. Divinely invested with the threefold office of the judge, prophet, and priest, he had labored with the untiring and disinterested zeal for the welfare of his people, and the nation had prospered under his wise control. And as we will remember that 144,000, when they come forth, they will hold the same office, a threefold office. They will hold the office of a prophet, priest, and king, and that's exactly the office that Yahshua held when he was here on earth. Prophet, priest, and king. But he reserved his kingship for the last, the end time. Order had been restored, and righteousness promoted, and the spirit of the discontent was checked for the time. But with the advancing years, the prophet was forced to share with others the cares of the government, and he appointed his two sons to act as his assistants. While Samuel continued the duties of his office at Ramah, the young men were stationed at Beersheba to administer justice among the people near the southern border of the land. Okay, it was with the full assent of the nation that Samuel had appointed his sons to office, but they did not prove themselves worthy of their father's choice. For the Yahweh had, through the Moses, given special directions unto his people, that the rulers of Israel should judge righteously, deal justly with the widow and the fatherless, and receive no bribes. But the sons of Samuel turned aside after lucre, and took bribes and perverted judgment, for the sons of the prophets had not heeded the precepts which he had sought to impress upon their mind. They had not copied the pure, unselfish life of their father, for the warning given unto Eli had not exerted the influence upon the mind of the Samuel that it should have done. He had been, to some extent, too indulgent with his sons, and the result was apparent in their character and love. For the injustice of these judges caused much dissatisfaction and a pretext was thus furnished for urging the change that had long been secretly desired. All the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came unto Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. For the cases of the abuse among the people had not been referred unto Samuel, had the evil course of his sons been known unto him, he would have removed them without delay. So you see, they didn't make this known unto Samuel, that this was not what the petitioners desired. Samuel saw that their real motive was discontent and pride, and that their demand was the result of a deliberate and determined purpose. So that's the reason why the people really didn't want a prophet to rule over them. They secretly in their hearts really wanted a king just like all the nations around them. And that's the reason why they withheld that information from Samuel about his two sons. Samuel didn't know his two sons were doing that. But the people of the land did, and they would not go and report it to Samuel. So he couldn't correct. He'd have corrected it immediately. But Samuel saw that they had a different intention. Their intention was that they wanted to get rid of the prophets in Israel. They didn't want no more prophets ruling over them. Well, that's the Seventh-day Adventist Church today. They don't want no prophets ruling over them. That's the reason they fought against Ellen G. White, like they did. And finally appointed another leadership in 1888, the General Conference leadership, to take Sister White's place, to rule over them. They didn't like that, Sister White, trying to get them back on natural health laws and trying to get them to appreciate and keep the Sabbath more fully and to understand it more fully and to study the subject of the 144,000 and how to restore the sanctuary completely. They didn't want to hear that. They were tired of hearing it. Well, that's what they were in Samuel's day. They were tired of hearing this, your school of the prophets, and trying to teach everybody in the land to be righteous and spiritual and holy. That's what the school of the prophets is for. Okay, no complaint had been made against Samuel. All acknowledged the integrity and wisdom of his administration. But the aged prophet looked upon the request as a censure upon himself and a direct effort to sit him aside. He did not, however, reveal his feelings. He uttered no reproach. He carried the matter to Yahweh in prayer and sought counsel from him alone. And Yahweh said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So the true intent, the true secret came out while the people did what they did. They were in conspiracy together with each other to not let it be known unto Samuel about the waywardness of his two sons. They did that intentionally because they not only didn't want a prophet ruling over them, but they didn't want Yahweh, their creator, ruling over them either. In other words, they wanted Satan to rule over them. They chose Satan instead of Yahweh and his son Yahshua and his prophets. But that's what the Adventist Church did today. They first rejected his prophet, Ellen G. White. Then they rejected anybody that was teaching her writings after that. And they appointed them a new leadership that was nothing but Jesuits taking over the Adventist leadership and appointing them a Jesuit General Conference president at the head of the Adventist Church. And all the officers underneath them were all Jesuit Catholics. They showed right there the Adventists, and the Adventists didn't rise up against it. Sister White had visions and dreams, and she said, the Catholic procession, she said, they come and take in possession of her goods, her writings. They said, this house is prescribed, and we're going to destroy it. And that's exactly what they did. And the Adventist membership were told this dream, and yet they didn't protect Sister White's writings. They didn't protect her. They let them go ahead and have a general conference in 1888, and over a two-year period of time, they completely evolved the Adventist Church from a Christian, from a purified trail that they were on, a trail to purification, to restoring the sanctuary fully, to completely destroying it, and the concept of the sanctuary system. Okay, let's continue on. According to all the works which they have done since the day, let's reread that paragraph. And the Yahweh said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. All right, now I want to ask you a question. Do you know of another place in the parables there in the New Testament where it talks about they sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man to rule over us? And Yahweh gave that to me down there in Kermit, Texas, there in Luke 19. And he gave that to me and said, this applies to this situation right here, where Verlus Johnson had rose up and said to Yahshua and Yahweh, said, I'll not have this man dead and drunken, this antithetical David he claimed to be. I'll not, this Elijah David, we will not have him rule over us. That's exactly where this all fits, right there. It says in Luke 19:14 and 15, it says, but his citizens hated him and sent a message after him, saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. They said that all the way down through the ages, ever since Samuel. They said, we'll not have this man to reign over us because we don't want his Yahshua to reign over us, and we don't want the Father Yahweh to reign over us. We want to be a free spirit and run our own lives according to our own interpretation. We want to live life freely. We don't want to be under no strict rules and laws and says you can't do this and you can't do that. When the lust of the flesh cries out and says, I want this and I want that, they want to have it right then and there, and they don't want nothing restricting it. That's exactly what we have today. We've always had that. That's what Israel has always had ever since they rebelled against Samuel and Yahweh and his son there in the Old Testament and wanted them a king. They have always wanted a king that would approve of their lustful desires. All right, let us continue on now. Let us go right on back to where we were left off our reading. It says there in 605, the first king of Israel, then patriarchs and prophets. Okay, so it says, and the Yahweh said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people, and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, and I should not reign over them. Well, that's what Yahweh said in 2002 to Kermit. He said, they haven't rejected you. They haven't rejected, they've rejected Yahweh the Father, first and foremost. By their actions, they show that they don't want anything of divine authority telling them how to grow up unto perfection and sanctification and holiness. They don't want any of that. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. The prophet was reproved for grieving at the conduct of the people toward himself as an individual. They had not manifested disrespect for him, but for the authority of Yahweh, who had appointed the rulers of his people. Those who despise and reject the faithful servant of Yahweh show contempt, not merely for the man, but for the master who sent him. It is Yahweh's words, his reproofs and counsels that are set at naught. It is his authority that is rejected. Okay, it says, one of the days, that's Israel's greatest prosperity. Let's do that again. For the days of the Israel's greatest prosperity had been those in which they acknowledged the Yahweh as their king. Now, just a minute. Let's look at that again. It says Jehovah as their king, which whenever you see the word Jehovah or the name Jehovah, it's referring to the Father. So you see how these Jesuits got into Ellen G. White's writings and just completely perverted the name of Yahweh and the meaning of who the king really is of Israel. Yahweh has appointed his son to be the king over Israel. All right, let's look at this again. For the days of Israel's greatest prosperity had been those in which they acknowledged the Yeshua, the Son, as their king. When the laws and the government which he had established were regarded as superior unto those of all other nations, Moses had declared unto Israel concerning the commandments of Yahweh, "This is your wisdom, your understanding, the sight of the nations which shall hear all of these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." But by departing from the Yahweh's law, the Hebrews had failed to become the people that Elohim desired to make them. And then all the evils which were the result of their own sin and folly they charged upon the government of Yahweh. So completely had they become blinded by the sin, for the Yahweh had, through his prophets, foretold that the Israel would be governed by a king. But it does not follow that this form of government was best for them or according unto his will. It says, he permitted the people to allow their own choice. He permitted the people to follow their own choice because they refused to be guided by his counsel. Okay, for the Hosea declares that Yahweh gave them a king in his anger. When men chose to have their own way without seeking counsel from Yahweh or in the opposition unto his revealed will. For he often grants their desires in the order that through the bitter experiences or the experience that follows, they may be led to realize their folly and repent of their sin. Human pride and wisdom will prove a dangerous guide. That which the heart desires contrary unto the will of Yahweh will in the end be found a curse rather than a blessing. For Yahweh desired his people to look unto him alone as their lawgiver. Let's do that again. For the Yeshua, the Son, desired his people to look unto him alone as their lawgiver. Now the scriptures plainly tell us that Yeshua, the tribe of Judah, is our lawgiver and their source of the strength. Feeling their dependence upon the Yahweh and their source of the strength, feeling their dependence upon the Yahweh, they would be constantly drawn nearer unto him. They would become elevated and ennobled, fitted for the high destiny under which he had called them as his chosen people. But when a man was placed upon the throne, he would tend to turn the minds of the people from the Yahweh. They would trust more unto the human strength and less unto the divine power. And the errors of their king would lead them into the sin and separate the nation from the Yahweh. So now you see why when Yahweh raises up a prophet over the church, he don't want no man sitting up there on a stage behind a lectern, a desk, preaching the word and being called the minister. He won't call himself a prophet. He calls himself the minister. And so they measure the minister's sermons by the prophet's writings. Ellen G. White, for instance, they would measure the preacher's sermons by her written word that she had written under inspiration. And then she would tell them, she said, when you take my words, make sure that they're to the law and the testimony. If they don't measure up to that, there's no light in my words either. So she always directed them back to the sure word of prophecy. And so there you have it. Three stages there in the Adventist church. You have the word. You have it given unto a prophet. And then the prophet has ministers underneath that prophet to go and preach and pass the word on to the people. And by the time it gets to that third stage, 1, 2, 3, that minister, he becomes the hierarchy. He becomes the number one authority, and everybody looks unto him. And he's the third one in the chain of command. But they look unto him as a real authority. And for teaching the truth. And so he's liable to teach anything. And the people will accept it because the preacher don't tell them any different. Samuel was interested for the granting of the request of the people. Really, he warned them of Yahweh's disapproval, and also make known of what would be the result of their course. And Samuel told all the words of the Yahweh and the people that asked of him a king. He faithfully set before them the burdens that would be laid upon them and showed the contrast between such a state of the oppression and their present comparatively free and prosperous condition. For their king would imitate the pomp and luxury of the other monarchs to support which grievous exactions upon their persons and property would be necessary. The goodness of their young men he would require for his service. They would be made as charioteers and horsemen and runners before him. He must fill the ranks of his army, and they would be required to till his fields, to reap his harvest, and to manufacture implements of war for his service. For the daughters of Israel would be taken for confectionaries and bakers for the royal household. To support his kingly state, he would seize upon the best of their land, bestowed upon the people by the Yahweh himself, the most valuable of their servants also, and of their cattle, he would take and put them to his own work. Besides all this, the king would require a tenth of all their income, the profits of their labor, or the products of the soil. You shall be his servants, concluded the prophet, and you shall cry out in that day because of your king, which you shall have chosen you, and the Yahweh will not hear you in that day, however burdensome its exactions should be found. When once a monarchy was established, they could not set it aside at the pleasure. Heard of the people returned the answer, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Like all the nations, the Israelites did not realize that to be in this respect, unlike other nations, was a special privilege and blessing. Yahweh has separated the Israelites from every other people to make them his own peculiar treasure. That they disregarded this high honor, eagerly desired to imitate the example of the heathen, and still the longing to conform to the worldly practices and customs exist among the professed people of Yahweh. As they depart from the Yahweh, they become ambitious for the gains and honors of the world. Christians are constantly seeking to imitate the practices of those who worship the God of this world, Satan. Many are urged that by the uniting with the worldlings and conforming unto their customs, they might exert a stronger influence over the unrighteous. But all who pursue this course thereby separate from the source of their strength, becoming the friends of the world, they are the enemies of Yahweh. For the sake of the earthly distinction, they sacrifice the unspeakable honor unto which Yahweh has called them, of the showing forth the praises of Him who has called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. With a deep sadness, Samuel listened unto the words of the people, but the Yahweh said unto him, hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. For the prophet had done his duty. He had faithfully presented the warning, and it had been rejected. This is the same thing that happened down at Kermit 2002. I faithfully delivered the message from heaven, and it had been rejected, and you know the results of it now. That place has been completely destroyed, and it is no more a sign that it ever existed. With a heavy heart, he dismissed the people and himself departed to prepare for the great change in the government. Samuel's life of the purity and unselfish devotion was a perpetual rebuke both unto the self-serving priests and elders and unto the proud, sensual congregation of Israel. Although he showed no pomp and made no display, his labors bore the signet of heaven. He was honored by the world's Redeemer, under whose guidance he ruled the Hebrew nation, but the people had become weary of his piety and devotion. They despised his humble authority and rejected him for a man who should rule them as a king. In the character of the Samuel, we see reflected the likeness of Yahshua. It was the purity of our Savior's life that provoked the wrath of the Satan. That life was the light of the world and revealed the hidden depravity in the hearts of man. It was the holiness of Yahshua that stirred up against him the fiercest passions of the false-hearted professors of the righteousness. Yahshua came not with the wealth and honors of the earth, yet the works which he wrought showed him to possess power greater than that of any human prince. For the Jews looked for the Messiah to break the oppressor's yoke, yet they cherished the sin that had bound it unto their necks. Upon their necks, had the Yahshua cloaked their sins and applauded their piety, they would have accepted him as their king. But they would not bear his fearless rebuke of their vices. For the loveliness of a character in which benevolence, purity, and holiness reign supreme, which entertain no hatred except for sin, they despise. Thus it has been in every age of the world. The light from heaven brings condemnation unto all who refuse to walk in it. When rebuked by the example of those who hate sin, hypocrites will become agents of the Satan to harass and persecute the faithful. All that will live righteously in Yahshua Messiah shall suffer persecution. Though a monarchical form of the government for the Israel had been foretold in the prophecy, Yahweh had reserved unto himself the right to choose their king. For the Hebrews so far respected the authority of Yahweh as to leave the selection entirely unto him. For the choice fell upon Saul, the son of Kish of the tribe of Benjamin. For the personal qualities of the future monarch were such as to gratify that pride of the heart which prompted the desire for a king. There was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he, of the noble and dignified bearing and the prime of the life. Comely and tall, he appeared like one born to command. Yet with these external attractions, Saul was destitute of those higher qualities that constitute true wisdom. He had not in the youth learned to control his rash, impetuous passion. He had never felt the renewing power of the divine grace. Saul was the son of a powerful and wealthy chief, yet in accordance with the simplicity of the time, he was engaged with his father in the humble duties of a husbandman. Some of his father's animals having strayed upon the mountains, Saul went with his servant to seek for them. For 3 days he searched in the vain. When as they were not far from Ramah, the home of the Samuel, the servant proposed that they should inquire of the prophet concerning the missing property. I was here at hand the fourth part. I have here at the hand the fourth part of a shekel of silver, he said. That will I give unto the man of Yahweh to tell us our way. Okay, he said this was in accordance with the custom of the time. A person approaching the superior in the rank or office made him a small present as an expression of the respect. As they drew near unto the city, they met some young maidens who had come out to draw water and inquired of them for the seer. In reply, they were told that a religious service was about to take place, that the prophet had already arrived. There was to be an offering upon the high place, and after that a sacrificial feast. A great change had taken place under Samuel's administration. When the call of Yahweh first came unto him, the services of the sanctuary were held in the contempt. Men abhorred the offering of Yahweh, but the worship of the Yahweh was now maintained throughout the land, and the people manifested an interest in the religious services. There had been no administration in the tabernacle. Sacrifices were for the time offered elsewhere in the cities of the priests and Levites, where the people resorted for the instruction, were chosen for this purpose. For the highest points in these cities were usually selected as the place of the sacrifice, and hence were called the high places. At the gate of the city, Samuel was met by the prophet himself. Yahweh had revealed, no, at the gate of the city, Saul was met by the prophet himself. for Yahweh had revealed unto Samuel that at that time the chosen king of Israel would present himself before him. As he now stood face to face, Yahweh said unto Samuel, Behold, the man whom I spake unto thee of, this same shall reign over my people. And to the request of Saul, tell me, I pray thee, where the seer's house is. Samuel replied, I am the seer. Assuring him also that the lost animals had been found, he urged him to tarry and attend the feast, at the same time giving some intimation of the great destiny before him, on whom and all the desire of Israel, is it not on thee and on all thy father's house? The listener's heart thrilled at the prophet's word. He could not but perceive something of their significance, for the demand for a king had become a matter of absorbing interest unto the whole nation. Yet, with the modest self-depreciation, Saul replied, Am not I Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my father the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Wherefore then speakest thou so unto me? Samuel conducted this. Okay, I'm going a little bit too fast. Let's back up. I'm coming to the end of my study. And my family, the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin, wherefore then speakest thou so unto me? Samuel conducted the stranger unto the place of the assembly, where the principal men of the town were gathered. Among them, at the prophet's direction, the place of the honor was given unto Saul. And at the feast, the choicest portion was set before him. For the services over, Samuel took his guests unto his own home, and there upon the housetop he communed with him, setting forth the great principles on which the government of Israel had been established, and thus seeking to prepare him in some measure for the high station. This same thing happened to Brother Johnson in 1970, as it did unto King Saul, his predecessor. When Saul departed early next morning, the prophet went forth with him. Having passed through the town, he directed the servant to go forward. Then he bade Saul stand still to receive a message sent him from the Yahweh. And Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, Is it not because Yahweh hath anointed thee to be captain over his inheritance? As the evidence that this was done by the divine authority, he foretold the instance that would occur on the homeward journey, and assured Saul that he would be qualified by the Spirit of Yahweh for the station awaiting him. The Spirit of Yahweh will come upon thee, said the prophet, and thou shalt be turned unto another man, and let it be, when these signs are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for Yahweh is with thee. Well, we still lack a little finish in this chapter, but I'm going to go ahead and bring this service to a close. We're going to close now with a song. He lives. Our Savior is in Savior, He's in the world today. I know that He is living wherever men may say. I see His hand of mercy, I hear His voice of cheer. In just the time I need Him, He's always near. He lives, He lives, Yahshua lives today. He walks with me and talks with me, the law must never obey. He lives, He lives, salvation to impart. Yes, we know He lives. In all the world around me, I see His loving care. And though my heart grows weary, I never will despair. I know that He is leading through all the stormy blast. The day of His appearing will come at last. He
Bless me, how